of a crime syndicate, and the Don has made it, shall we say, all too clear that any informants will sleep with the fishes. This alteration to the game's payoffs has the effect of limiting the actions you can take, yet ironically makes it far more likely that things will end well, both for you and your partner. Since defection is now less attractive, to put it mildly, both prisoners are induced to cooperate, and both will confidently walk away $500,000 richer. Minus, of course, a nominal tithe to the Don. The counterintuitive and powerful thing here is we can worsen every outcome, death on the one hand, taxes on the other, yet make everyone's lives better by shifting the equilibrium. For the small-town shopkeepers, a verbal truce to take Sundays off would be unstable. As soon as either shopkeeper needed some extra cash, he'd be liable to violate it, prompting the other to start working Sundays as well, so as not to lose market share. This would land them right back in the bad equilibrium, where they got the worst of both worlds. They're exhausted and don't get any competitive advantage for it. But they might be able to act as their own Don, by signing a legally binding contract to the effect that, say, any proceeds earned by either shop on a Sunday go to the other shop. By worsening the unsatisfactory equilibrium, they'd make a new and better one. On the other hand, a change to the game's payoffs that doesn't change the equilibrium will typically have a much smaller effect than desired. The CEO of the software firm Evernote, Phil Libin, made headlines with a policy of offering Evernote employees $1,000 cash for taking a vacation. This sounds like a reasonable approach to getting more employees to take vacation, but from a game theoretic perspective, it's actually misguided. Increasing the cash on the table in the prisoner's dilemma, for instance, misses the point. The change doesn't do anything to alter the bad equilibrium. If a $1 million heist ends up with both thieves in jail, so does a $10 million heist. The problem isn't that vacations aren't attractive. The problem is that everyone wants to take slightly less vacation than their peers, producing a game whose only equilibrium is no vacation at all. $1,000 sweetens the deal, but doesn't change the principle of the game, which is to take as much vacation as possible while still being perceived as slightly more loyal than the next guy or gal, therefore getting a raise or promotion over them that's worth many thousands of dollars. Does this mean that Libin needs to offer tens of thousands of dollars per employee per vacation? No. Mechanism design tells us that Libin can get the happy employees he wants with the stick rather than the carrot. He can get a better equilibrium without spending a dime. For instance, he could simply make a certain minimal amount of vacation compulsory. If he can't change the race, he can still change the bottom. Mechanism design makes a powerful argument for the need for a designer, be it a CEO, a contract binding all parties, or a Don who enforces omerta by garroted. A league commissioner is this kind of designer as well. Imagine how pathetic a sight the NBA would be if there were no games as such, and teams could simply score on each other at literally any time between the start and end of the season. 3 a.m. on a Sunday, noon on Christmas, you name it. What you'd see would be haggard, cadaverous players, in extreme sleep debt, forcing vigilance with chemical stimulants, almost losing their minds. War is like this. On the other hand, even Wall Street, ruthless cutthroat capitalists trading by the microsecond in the city that never sleeps, comes to a ceasefire every day at 4 p.m. sharp, so that brokers can sleep at predictable hours every night without getting too badly ambushed by competitors pushing toward a sleepless equilibrium. In this sense, the stock market is more a sport than a war. Scaling up this logic results in a potent argument for the role of government. In fact, many governments do have laws on the books mandating minimum vacations and limiting shop hours. And while the United States is one of the only developed nations without federal requirements for paid vacation, Massachusetts, Maine, and Rhode Island do have state-level prohibitions on Thanksgiving commerce. Laws like these often stem from the colonial era and were initially religious in nature. Indeed, religion itself provides a very direct way of modifying the structure of games of this kind. In particular, a religious law such as "Remember the Sabbath Day" neatly solves the problem faced by the shopkeepers, whether enforced by an all-powerful god or by the more proximate members of the religious community. And adding divine force to injunctions against other kinds of antisocial behavior, such as murder, adultery, and theft, is likewise a way to solve some of the game-theoretic problems of living in a social group. God happens to be even better than government in this respect, since omniscience and omnipotence provide a particularly strong guarantee that taking bad actions will have dire consequences. It turns out there's no godfather quite like God the Father. Religion seems like the kind of thing a computer scientist rarely talks about. In fact, it's literally the subject of a book called Things a Computer Scientist Rarely Talks About. But by reducing the number of options that people have, behavioral constraints of the kind imposed by religion don't just make certain kinds of decisions less computationally challenging, they can also yield better outcomes. Mechanism design by evolution. How selfish soever man may be supposed, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortune of others and render their happiness necessary to him, though he derives nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing it. Adam Smith, The Theory of Moral Sentiments. The heart has its reasons, which reason knows nothing of. Blaise Pascal. The redwoods of California are some of the oldest and most majestic living things on the planet. From a game-theoretic standpoint, though, there's something of a tragedy. The only reason they're so tall is that they're trying to be taller than each other, up to the point where the harms of overextension are finally even worse than the harms of getting shaded out. As Richard Dawkins puts it, the canopy can be thought of as an aerial meadow, just like a rolling grassland prairie, but raised on stilts. The canopy is gathering solar energy at much the same rate as a grassland prairie would. But a substantial portion of the energy is wasted by being fed straight into the stilts, which do nothing more useful than loft the meadow high in the air, where it picks up exactly the same harvest of photons as it would, at far lower cost, if it were laid flat on the ground. If the forest could only somehow agree to a kind of truce, the ecosystem could enjoy the photosynthetic bounty without the wood-making arms race wasting it all. But as we've seen, good outcomes in these scenarios tend only to arise in the context of an authority outside the game, someone changing the payoffs from the top down. It would seem as though in nature, then, there is simply no way of establishing good equilibria between individuals. On the other hand, if cooperation really does lead to better outcomes in certain games, then we'd expect that cooperatively minded species would prevail evolutionarily. But then where would the cooperation come from if it's only rational at the group level, not the individual level? Maybe it would have to come from something that individuals can't entirely control. Something, for instance, like emotions. Consider two seemingly unrelated scenarios. One, a man buys a vacuum cleaner. It breaks within a few weeks, and he spends 10 minutes online leaving a vindictive review. Two, a woman shopping at a convenience store notices someone steal an elderly man's wallet and bolt for the door. She tackles the thief and wrestles the wallet free. Though the latter protagonist seems clearly heroic, and the former merely angry, what these vignettes have in common, albeit in very different ways, is involuntary selflessness. The unhappy consumer isn't trying to get the vacuum cleaner replaced or his money back. He's after a highly indirect kind of retribution, from which, in a rational game-theoretic sense, he stands to gain little, other than the spiteful satisfaction of writing the review itself. In the convenience store, the heroic woman metes out vigilante justice at enormous personal cost. She risks injury or even death to return, say, $40 to a man who is a total stranger to her. Even if she wanted to help, she could have simply taken two 20s out of her own pocket and given them to him without risking a trip to the ER. In this sense, both protagonists are acting irrationally. On the other hand, their actions are good for their society. We all want to live in a world in which pickpocketing doesn't pay, and in which businesses that sell poor quality products get a bad reputation. Perhaps each of us, individually, would be better off being the kind of person who can always make a detached, calculated decision in their own best interest, not willing to lose time fuming over a sunk cost, let alone lose a tooth over $40. But all of us are better off living in a society in which such defiant stands are common. So what has acted up in these people, in the absence of an external authority, to make them buck the selfish equilibrium? Anger, for one thing. Whether prompted by a shoddy business or a petty thief, outrage can override rationality. And in these instances, it may be that the hand of evolution has done what it otherwise would have taken an authority outside the game to accomplish. Nature is full of examples of individuals being essentially hijacked to serve the goals of another species. The Lancet liver fluke, for instance, is a parasite that makes ants deliberately climb to the tops of grass blades so they'll be eaten by sheep, the Lancet fluke's preferred host. Likewise, the parasite Toxoplasma gondii makes mice permanently lose their fear of cats, with similar results. Emotion, for the bitter, retaliatory consumer and for the convenience store hero alike, is our own species taking over the controls for a minute. Morality is herd instinct in the individual, wrote Nietzsche. Paraphrasing slightly, we might hazard that emotion is mechanism design in the species. Precisely because feelings are involuntary, they enable contracts that need no outside enforcement. Revenge almost never works out in favor of the one who seeks it, and yet someone who will respond with irrational vehemence to being taken advantage of is for that very reason more likely to get a fair deal. As Cornell economist Robert Frank puts it, if people expect us to respond irrationally to the theft of our property, we will seldom need to, because it will not be in their interests to steal it. Being predisposed to respond irrationally serves much better here than being guided only by material self-interest. Lest you think that civilized modern humans have legal contracts and rule of law instead of retribution, recall that it's often more work and suffering to sue or prosecute someone than the victim could ever hope to recover in material terms. Lawsuits are the means for self-destructive retaliation in a developed society, not the substitute. As for anger, so for compassion and guilt and love. As odd as it might sound, the prisoner's dilemma also has a lot to tell us about marriage. In our discussion of optimal stopping problems, such as the secretary problem, back in Chapter 1, we looked at both dating and apartment hunting as cases where we must make a commitment with possible future options yet unseen. In both love and housing, though, we continue to encounter more options even after our optimal stopping decision is made. So why not be ready to jump ship? Of course, knowing that the other party, be it spouse or landlord, is in turn prepared to jump ship, would prevent many of the long-term investments, having children together or laboriously moving in one's belongings, that make those agreements worthwhile. In both cases, this so-called commitment problem can be at least partially addressed by a contract. But game theory suggests that in the case of dating, the voluntary bonds of the law are less relevant to an enduring partnership than the involuntary bonds of love itself. As Robert Frank puts it, the worry that people will leave relationships because it may later become rational for them to do so is largely erased if it is not rational assessment that binds them in the first place. He explains, yes, people search for objective characteristics they care about. Everybody wants somebody who's kind and intelligent and interesting and healthy and may be physically attractive, good earning power, the whole laundry list of features. But that's the first pass. After you've spent enough time together, it's not those things that make you want to stay together. It's just the fact that it's that particular person. That is what's valuable to you. So you don't really need the contract so much as you need a feeling that makes you not want to separate, even though objectively there might be a better option available to you. Said differently, love is like organized crime. It changes the structure of the marriage game so that the equilibrium becomes the outcome that works best for everybody. Playwright George Bernard Shaw once wrote of marriage that, if the prisoner is happy, why lock him in? If he is not, why pretend that he is? Game theory offers a subtle answer to this particular riddle. Happiness is the lock. A game theoretic argument for love would highlight one further point. Marriage is a prisoner's dilemma in which you get to choose the person with whom you're in cahoots. This might seem like a small change, but it potentially has a big effect on the structure of the game you're playing. If you knew that for some reason your partner in crime would be miserable if you weren't around, the kind of misery even $1 million couldn't cure, then you'd worry much less about them defecting and leaving you to rot in jail. So the rational argument for love is twofold. The emotions of attachment not only spare you from recursively overthinking your partner's intentions, but by changing the payoffs, actually enable a better outcome altogether. What's more, being able to fall involuntarily in love makes you, in turn, a more attractive partner to have. Your capacity for heartbreak, for sleeping with the emotional fishes, is the very quality that makes you such a trusty accomplice. Information cascades, the tragic rationality of bubbles. Whenever you find yourself on the side of the majority, it is time to pause and reflect. Mark Twain. Part of the reason why it's a good idea to pay attention to the behavior of others is that in doing so, you get to add their information about the world to your own. A popular restaurant is probably good. A half-empty concert hall is probably a bad sign. And if someone you're talking to abruptly yanks their gaze towards something you can't see, it's probably not a bad idea to turn your head, too. On the other hand, learning from others doesn't always seem particularly rational. Fads and fashions are the result of following others' behavior without being anchored to any underlying objective truth about the world. What's worse, the assumption that other people's actions are a useful guide can lead to the sort of herd following that precipitates economic disaster. If everybody else is investing in real estate, it seems like a good idea to buy a house. After all, the price is only going to go up, isn't it? An interesting aspect of the 2007 to 2009 mortgage crisis is that everybody involved seemed to feel like they were unfairly punished for simply doing what they were supposed to do. A generation of Americans who grew up believing that houses were fail-safe investments and who saw everyone around them buying houses despite or because of rapidly rising prices were badly burned when those prices finally started to tumble. Bankers, meanwhile, felt they were unfairly blamed for doing what they had always done, offering opportunities which their clients could accept or decline. In the wake of an abrupt market collapse, the temptation is always to assign blame. Here, game theory offers a sobering perspective. Catastrophes like this can happen even when no one's at fault. Properly appreciating the mechanics of financial bubbles begins with understanding auctions. While auctions may seem like niche corners of the economy, evoking either million-dollar oil paintings at Sotheby's and Christie's or Beanie Babies and other collectibles on eBay, they actually power a substantial portion of the economy. Google, for instance, makes more than 90% of its revenue from selling ads, and those ads are all sold via auctions. Meanwhile, governments use auctions to sell rights to bands at the telecommunications spectrum, such as cell phone transmission frequencies, raising tens of billions of dollars in revenue. In fact, many global markets, in everything from homes to books to tulips, operate via auctions of various styles. One of the simplest auction formats has each participant write down their bid in secret, and the one whose bid is highest wins the item for whatever price they wrote down. This is known as a sealed bid first price auction. And from an algorithmic game theory perspective, there's a big problem with it. Actually, several. For one thing, there's a sense in which the winner always overpays. If you value an item at $25 and I value it at $10, and we both bid our true valuations, $25 and $10, then you end up buying it for $25 when you could have had it for just a hair over $10. This problem, in turn, leads to another one, which is that in order to bid properly, that is, in order not to overpay, you need to predict the true valuation of the other players in the auction and shade your bid accordingly. That's bad enough, but the other players aren't going to bid their true valuations either, because they're shading their bids based on their prediction of yours. We are back in the land of recursion. Another classic auction format, the Dutch auction, or descending auction, gradually lowers an item's price until someone is willing to buy it. The name references the Alsmeer flower auction, the largest flower auction in the world, which takes place daily in the Netherlands. But Dutch auctions are more prevalent than they might initially seem. A store marking down its unsold items, and landlords listing apartments at the highest price they think the market will bear, both share its basic quality. The seller is likely to begin optimistically and nudge the price down until a buyer is found. The descending auction resembles the first price auction in that you're more likely to win by paying near the top of your range. That is, you'll be poised to bid as the price falls to $25, and therefore will want to shade your offer by some complexly strategic amount. Do you buy at $25 or stay your hand and try to wait for a lower price? Every dollar you save risks losing out altogether. The inverse of a Dutch or descending auction is what's known as an English auction or ascending auction, the most familiar auction format. In an English auction, bidders alternate raising the price until all but one of them drop out. This seems to offer something closer to what we want. Here, if you value an item at $25 and I value it at $10, you'll win it for just over $10 without either having to go all the way to $25 or disappearing down the strategic rabbit hole. Both the Dutch auction and English auction introduce an extra level of complexity when compared to a sealed bid auction, however. They involve not only the private information that each bidder has, but also the public flow of bidding behavior. In a Dutch auction, it is the absence of a bid that reveals information by making it clear that none of the other bidders value the item at the current price level. And under the right circumstances, this mixing of private and public data can prove toxic. Imagine the bidders are doubtful about their own estimations of the value of an auction lot, say, the right to drill for oil in some part of the ocean. As University College London game theorist Ken Binmore notes, the amount of oil in a tract is the same for everybody, but the buyer's estimates of how much oil is likely to be in a tract will depend on their differing geological surveys. Such surveys aren't only expensive, but notoriously unreliable. In such a situation, it seems natural to look closely at your opponent's bids to augment your own meager private information with the public information. But this public information might not be nearly as informative as it seems. You don't actually get to know the other bidder's beliefs, only their actions. And it is entirely possible that their behavior is based on your own, just as your behavior is being influenced by theirs. It's easy to imagine a bunch of people all going over a cliff together because everyone else was acting as though it'd all be fine, when in reality each person had qualms but suppressed them because of the apparent confidence of everyone else in the group. Just as with the tragedy of the commons, this failure is not necessarily the player's fault. An enormously influential paper by the economists Sushil Bikchandani, David Hirschleifer, and Ivo Welch has demonstrated that under the right circumstances, A group of agents who are all behaving perfectly rationally and perfectly appropriately can nonetheless fall prey to what is effectively infinite misinformation. This has come to be known as an information cascade. To continue the oil drilling rights scenario, imagine there are 10 companies that might bid on the rights for a given tract. One of them has a geological survey suggesting the tract is rich with oil. Another's survey is inconclusive. The reconnaissance of the other 8 suggests it's barren. But being competitors, of course, the companies do not share their survey results with each other, and instead can only watch each other's actions. When the auction begins, the first company with the promising report makes a high initial bid. The second company, encouraged by this bid to take an optimistic view of their own ambiguous survey, bids even higher. The third company has a weak survey, but now doesn't trust it in light of what they take to be 2 independent surveys that suggest it's a gold mine. So they make a new high bid. The fourth company, which also has a lackluster survey, is now even more strongly inclined to disregard it, as it seems like 3 of their competitors all think it's a winner. So they bid too. The consensus unglues from reality. A cascade has formed. No single bidder has acted irrationally, yet the net result is catastrophe. As Hirschleifer puts it, something very important happens once somebody decides to follow blindly his predecessors, independently of his own information signal. And that is that his action becomes uninformative to all later decision makers. Now the public pool of information is no longer growing. That welfare benefit of having public information has ceased. To see what happens in the real world when an information cascade takes over, and the bidders have almost nothing but one another's behavior to estimate an item's value, look no further than Peter A. Lawrence's developmental biology text, The Making of a Fly, which in April 2011 was selling for $23,698,655.93 plus $3.99 shipping on Amazon's third-party marketplace. How and why had this admittedly respected book reached a sale price of more than $23 million? It turns out that 2 of the sellers were setting their prices algorithmically as constant fractions of each other. One was always setting it to 0.99830 times the competitor's price, while the competitor was automatically setting their own price to 1.27059 times the other's. Neither seller apparently thought to set any limit on the resulting numbers, and eventually the process spiraled totally out of control. It's possible that a similar mechanism was in play during the enigmatic and controversial stock market flash crash of May 6, 2010, when, in a matter of minutes, the price of several seemingly random companies in the S&P 500 rose to more than $100,000 a share, while others dropped precipitously, sometimes to 1 cent a share. Almost $1 trillion of value instantaneously went up in smoke. As CNBC's Jim Cramer reported live, dumbfounded, "That, it can't be there. That is not a real price. Oh, well, just go buy Procter. Just go buy Procter & Gamble. They reported a decent quarter. Just go buy it. I mean, this is a good opportunity." Cramer's incredulity is his private information holding up against the public information. He's seemingly the only person in the world willing to pay, in this case, $49 for a stock that the market is apparently valuing at under $40. But he doesn't care. He's seen the quarterly reports. He's certain in what he knows. Investors are said to fall into 2 broad camps. Fundamental investors, who trade on what they perceive as the underlying value of a company, and technical investors, who trade on the fluctuations of the market. The rise of high-speed algorithmic trading has upset the balance between these 2 strategies, and it's frequently complained that computers, unanchored to the real-world value of goods, unbothered at pricing a textbook at tens of millions of dollars and blue-chip stocks at a penny, worsen the irrationality of the market. But while this critique is typically leveled at computers, people do the same kind of thing too, as any number of investment bubbles can testify. Again, the fault is often not with the players, but with the game itself. Information cascades offer a rational theory not only of bubbles, but also of fads and herd behavior more generally. They offer an account of how it's easily possible for any market to spike and collapse, even in the absence of irrationality, malevolence, or malfeasance. The takeaways are several. For one, be wary of cases where public information seems to exceed private information, where you know more about what people are doing than why they're doing it, where you're more concerned with your judgments fitting the consensus than fitting the facts. When you're mostly looking to others to set a course, they may well be looking right back at you to do the same. Second, remember that actions are not beliefs. Cascades get caused in part when we misinterpret what others think based on what they do. We should be especially hesitant to overrule our own doubts, and if we do, we might want to find some way to broadcast those doubts even as we move forward, lest others fail to distinguish the reluctance in our minds from the implied enthusiasm in our actions. Last, we should remember from the prisoner's dilemma that sometimes a game can have irredeemably lousy rules. There may be nothing we can do once we're in it, but the theory of information cascades may help us to avoid such a game in the first place. And if you're the kind of person who always does what you think is right, no matter how crazy others think it is, take heart. The bad news is that you will be wrong more often than the herd followers. The good news is that sticking to your convictions creates a positive externality, letting people make accurate inferences from your behavior. There may come a time when you will save the entire herd from disaster. To thine own self, compute. The application of computer science to game theory has revealed that being obligated to strategize is itself a part, often a big part, of the price we pay in competing with one another. And as the difficulties of recursion demonstrate, nowhere is that price as high as when we're required to get inside each other's heads. Here, algorithmic game theory gives us a way to rethink mechanism design, to take into account not only the outcome of the games, but also the computational effort required of the players. We've seen how seemingly innocuous auction mechanisms, for instance, can run into all sorts of problems, overthinking, overpaying, runaway cascades. But the situation is not completely hopeless. In fact, there's one auction design in particular that cuts through the burden of mental recursion like a hot knife through butter. It's called the Vickrey auction. Named for Nobel Prize-winning economist William Vickrey, the Vickrey auction, just like the first price auction, is a sealed bid auction process. That is, every participant simply writes down a single number in secret, and the highest bidder wins. However, in a Vickrey auction, the winner ends up paying not the amount of their own bid, but that of the second place bidder. That is to say, if you bid $25 and I bid $10, you win the item at my price. You only have to pay $10. To a game theorist, a Vickrey auction has a number of attractive properties. And to an algorithmic game theorist in particular, one property especially stands out. The participants are incentivized to be honest. In fact, there is no better strategy than just bidding your true value for the item, exactly what you think the item is worth. Bidding any more than your true value is obviously silly, as you might end up stuck buying something for more than you think it's worth. And bidding any less than your true value, that is, shading your bid, risks losing the auction for no good reason, since it doesn't save you any money. Because if you win, you'll only be paying the value of the second highest bid, regardless of how high your own was. This makes the Vickrey auction what mechanism designers call strategy-proof, or just truthful. In the Vickrey auction, honesty is literally the best policy. Even better, honesty remains the best policy regardless of whether the other bidders are honest themselves. In the prisoner's dilemma, we saw how defection turned out to be the dominant strategy, the best move no matter whether your partner defected or cooperated. In a Vickrey auction, on the other hand, honesty is the dominant strategy. This is the mechanism designer's holy grail. You do not need to strategize or recurse. Now, it seems like the Vickrey auction would cost the seller some money compared to the first price auction, but this isn't necessarily true. In a first price auction, every bidder is shading their bid down to avoid overpaying. In the second price Vickrey auction, there's no need to. In a sense, the auction itself is optimally shading their bid for them. In fact, a game theoretic principle called revenue equivalence establishes that over time, the average expected sale price in a first price auction will converge to precisely the same as in a Vickrey auction. Thus, the Vickrey equilibrium involves the same bidder winning the item for the same price, without any strategizing by any of the bidders whatsoever. As Tim Roughgarden tells his Stanford students, the Vickrey auction is awesome. For Hebrew University algorithmic game theorist Noam Nissan, this awesomeness has an air to it that's nearly utopian. You would like to get some kind of rules of society where it's not worthwhile to lie and then people won't lie so much, right? That's the basic idea. From my point of view, the amazing thing about Vickrey is that you wouldn't expect that in general it's possible to do that, right? Especially in things like an auction where, of course, I want to pay less. How can you ever get, and then yet Vickrey shows, here is the way to do that. I think that's really fantastic. In fact, the lesson here goes far beyond auctions. In a landmark finding called the Revelation Principle, Nobel laureate Roger Meyerson proved that any game that requires strategically masking the truth can be transformed into a game that requires nothing but simple honesty. Paul Milgram, Meyerson's colleague at the time, reflects, "It's one of those results that as you look at it from different sides, on the one side, it's just absolutely shocking and amazing, and on the other side, it's trivial. And that's totally wonderful. It's so awesome. That's how you know you're looking at one of the best things you can see." The revelation principle may seem hard to accept on its face, but its proof is actually quite intuitive. Imagine that you have an agent or a lawyer who will be playing the game for you. If you trust them to represent your interests, you're going to simply tell them exactly what you want and let them handle all of the strategic bid shading and the recursive strategizing on your behalf. In the Vickrey auction, the game itself performs this function. And the revelation principle just expands the idea. Any game that can be played for you by agents to whom you'll tell the truth, it says, will become an honesty is best game if the behavior you want from your agent is incorporated into the rules of the game itself. As Nissan puts it, the basic thing is if you don't want your clients to optimize against you, you'd better optimize for them. That's the whole proof. If I design an algorithm that already optimizes for you, there is nothing you can do. Algorithmic game theory has made huge contributions to a number of practical applications over the past 20 years. Helping us understand packet routing on the internet, improving FCC spectrum auctions that allocate precious, if invisible, public goods, and enhancing the matching algorithms that pair medical students with hospitals, among others. And this is likely just the beginning of a much larger transformation. "We are just scratching the surface," says Nissan. "Even in the theory, we are just starting to understand it. And there is another generation, probably, until what I completely understand today theoretically will successfully be applied to humans. It's a generation. I think not more than that. It will take a generation." French existentialist philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre famously wrote that hell is other people. He didn't mean that others are inherently malicious or unpleasant, but rather that they complicate our own thoughts and beliefs. When we think about ourselves, when we try to know ourselves, we use the knowledge of us which other people already have. We judge ourselves with the means other people have and have given us for judging ourselves. Into whatever I say about myself, someone else's judgment always enters. Into whatever I feel within myself, someone else's judgment enters. But that does not at all mean that one cannot have relations with other people. It simply brings out the capital importance of all other people for each one of us. Perhaps, given what we've learned in this chapter, we might endeavor to revise Sartre's statement. Interacting with others doesn't have to be a nightmare, although in the wrong game it surely can be. As Keynes observed, popularity is complicated, intractable, a recursive hall of mirrors, but beauty, in the eye of the beholder, is not. Adopting a strategy that doesn't require anticipating, predicting, reading into, or changing course because of the tactics of others is one way to cut the Gordian knot of recursion. And sometimes that strategy is not just easy, it's optimal. If changing strategies doesn't help, you can try to change the game. And if that's not possible, you can at least exercise some control about which games you choose to play. The road to hell is paved with intractable recursions, bad equilibria, and information cascades. Seek out games where honesty is the dominant strategy. Then, just be yourself. Conclusion: Computational Kindness. I firmly believe that the important things about humans are social in character, and that relief by machines from many of our present demanding intellectual functions will finally give the human race time and incentive to learn how to live well together. Merrill Flood. Any dynamic system subject to the constraints of space and time is up against a core set of fundamental and unavoidable problems. These problems are computational in nature, which makes computers not only our tools, but also our comrades. From this come three simple pieces of wisdom. First, there are cases where computer scientists and mathematicians have identified good algorithmic approaches that can simply be transferred over to human problems. The 37% rule, the least recently used criterion for handling overflowing caches, and the upper confidence bound as a guide to exploration are all examples of this. Second, knowing that you are using an optimal algorithm should be a relief even if you don't get the results you are looking for. The 37% rule fails 63% of the time. Maintaining your cache with LRU doesn't guarantee that you will always find what you're looking for. In fact, neither would clairvoyance. Using the upper confidence bound approach to the explore-exploit trade-off doesn't mean that you will have no regrets, just that those regrets will accumulate ever more slowly as you go through life. Even the best strategy sometimes yields bad results, which is why computer scientists take care to distinguish between process and outcome. If you followed the best possible process, then you've done all you can, and you shouldn't blame yourself if things didn't go your way. Outcomes make news headlines. Indeed, they make the world we live in, so it's easy to become fixated on them. But processes are what we have control over. As Bertrand Russell put it, it would seem we must take account of probability in judging objective rightness. The objectively right act is the one which will probably be most fortunate. I shall define this as the wisest act. We can hope to be fortunate, but we should strive to be wise. Call it a kind of computational stoicism. Finally, we can draw a clear line between problems that admit straightforward solutions and problems that don't. If you wind up stuck in an intractable scenario, remember that heuristics, approximations, and strategic use of randomness can help you find workable solutions. A theme that came up again and again in our interviews with computer scientists was, sometimes good enough really is good enough. What's more, being aware of complexity can help us pick our problems. If we have control over which situations we confront, we should choose the ones that are tractable. But we don't only pick the problems that we pose to ourselves. we also pick the problems that we pose each other, whether it's the way we design a city or the way we ask a question. This creates a surprising bridge from computer science to ethics in the form of a principle that we call computational kindness. There's a certain paradox the two of us observed when it came to scheduling the interviews that went into this book. Our interviewees were, on average, more likely to be available when we requested a meeting, say, next Tuesday between 1 and 2 p.m. Pacific time, than at a convenient time this coming week. At first, this seems absurd, like the celebrated studies where people on average donate more money to save the life of one penguin than 8,000 penguins, or report being more worried about dying in an act of terrorism than about dying from any cause, terrorism included. In the case of interviews, it seems that people preferred receiving a constrained problem, even if the constraints were plucked out of thin air, than a wide open one. It was seemingly less difficult for them to accommodate our preferences and constraints than to compute a better option based on their own. Computer scientists would nod knowingly here, citing the complexity gap between verification and search, which is about as wide as the gap between knowing a good song when you hear it and writing one on the spot. One of the implicit principles of computer science, as odd as it may sound, is that computation is bad. The underlying directive of any good algorithm is to minimize the labor of thought. When we interact with other people, we present them with computational problems, not just explicit requests and demands, but implicit challenges such as interpreting our intentions, our beliefs, and our preferences. It stands to reason, therefore, that a computational understanding of such problems casts light on the nature of human interaction. We can be computationally kind to others by framing issues in terms that make the underlying computational problem easier. This matters because many problems, especially social ones as we've seen, are intrinsically and inextricably hard. Consider this all too common scenario. A group of friends are standing around trying to figure out where to go for dinner. Each of them clearly has some preferences, albeit potentially weak ones. But none of them wants to state those preferences explicitly, so they politely navigate the social hazards with guesses and half-hints instead. They may well come to a resolution that is satisfying to all, but this procedure can easily go awry. The summer after college, for instance, two friends and I took a trip to Spain. We negotiated the trip itinerary on the fly, and at one point it became clear that we wouldn't have time to go to the bullfight we'd researched and planned. Only then, as each of the three of us attempted to console the others, did we suddenly discover that in fact none of us had wanted to see the bullfight in the first place. Each had just gamely adopted what we'd perceived to be the other's level of enthusiasm, thereby producing the level of enthusiasm that the others gamely adopted in turn. Likewise, seemingly innocuous language like, "Oh, I'm flexible," or "What do you want to do tonight?" has a dark computational underbelly that should make you think twice. It has the veneer of kindness about it, but it does two deeply alarming things. First, it passes the cognitive buck. Here's a problem, you handle it. Second, by not stating your preferences, it invites the others to simulate or imagine them. And as we have seen, the simulation of the minds of others is one of the biggest computational challenges a mind or machine can ever face. In such situations, computational kindness and conventional etiquette diverge. Politely withholding your preferences puts the computational problem of inferring them on the rest of the group. In contrast, politely asserting your preferences, "Personally, I'm inclined toward X, what do you think?" helps shoulder the cognitive load of moving the group toward resolution. Alternatively, you can try to reduce, rather than maximize, the number of options that you give other people. Say, offering a choice between 2 or 3 restaurants rather than 10. If each person in the group eliminates their least preferred option, that makes the task easier for everyone. And if you're inviting somebody out to lunch or scheduling a meeting, offering 1 or 2 concrete proposals that they can accept or decline is a good starting point. None of these actions is necessarily polite, but all of them can significantly lower the computational cost of interaction. Computational kindness isn't just a principle of behavior, it's also a design principle. In 2003, University of Waterloo computer scientist Jeffrey Shallet investigated the question of what coin, if put into circulation in the United States, would most help to minimize the number of coins needed on average to make change. Delightfully, the answer turned out to be an 18-cent piece. But Shallet was somewhat stayed from making a policy recommendation by computational concerns. At present, change-making is dead simple. For any given amount, just use as many quarters as you can without going over, then as many dimes as possible, and so on down the denominations. For instance, 54 cents is 2 quarters, then 4 pennies. With an 18-cent piece, that simple algorithm is no longer optimal. 54 cents is then best made with 3 18-cent pieces, and no quarters at all. In fact, Shallet observed that ungainly denominations turn change-making into something at least as hard as the traveling salesman problem. That's a lot to ask of a cashier. If ease of computation is taken into account, Shallet found, then what the U.S. money supply could best make use of is either a 2-cent or a 3-cent piece. Not quite as exciting as an 18-cent coin, but almost as good and computationally kinder by a long shot. The deeper point is that subtle changes in design can radically shift the kind of cognitive problem posed to human users. Architects and urban planners, for instance, have choices about how they construct our environment, which means that they have choices about how they will structure the computational problems we have to solve. Consider a large parking lot with an array of different lanes, of the kind often found at stadiums and shopping centers. You may drive in one lane toward the destination, see a spot, decide to let it go in favor of hopefully a better one further ahead, but then, finding no such luck, reach the destination and head away down a neighboring lane. After a certain amount of driving, you must decide whether another space is good enough to take, or so far away that you'll try searching in a third lane instead. An algorithmic perspective here is useful not just for the driver, but also for the architect. Contrast the hairy, messy decision problem posed by one of those lots to a single linear path going away from one's destination. In that case, one simply takes the first available space. No game theory, no analysis, no look-then-leap rule needed. Some parking garages are structured this way, with a single helix winding upward from the ground level. Their computational load is zero. One simply drives forward until the first space appears, then takes it. Whatever the other possible factors for and against this kind of construction, we can definitely say that it's cognitively humane to its drivers, computationally kind. One of the chief goals of design ought to be protecting people from unnecessary tension, friction, and mental labor. This is not just an abstract concern. When mall parking becomes a source of stress, for example, shoppers may spend less money and return less frequently. Urban planners and architects routinely weigh how different lot designs will use resources such as limited space, materials, and money, but they rarely account for the way their designs tax the computational resources of the people who use them. Recognizing the algorithmic underpinnings of our daily lives, in this case optimal stopping, would not only allow drivers to make the best decisions when they're in a particular scenario, but also encourage planners to be more thoughtful about the problems they're forcing drivers into in the first place. There are a number of other cases where computationally kinder designs suggest themselves. For example, consider restaurant seating policies. Some restaurants have an open seating policy where waiting customers simply hover until a table opens up, and the first to sit down gets the table. Others will take your name, let you have a drink at the bar, and notify you when a table is ready. These approaches to the management of scarce shared resources mirror the distinction in computer science between spinning and blocking. When a processing thread requests a resource and can't get it, the computer can either allow that thread to spin, to continue checking for the resource in a perpetual is-it-ready-yet loop, or it can block, halt that thread, work on something else, and then come back around whenever the resource becomes free. To a computer scientist, this is a practical trade-off, weighing the time lost to spinning against the time lost in context switching. But at a restaurant, not all of the resources being traded off are their own. A policy of spinning fills empty tables faster, but the CPUs being worn out in the meantime are the minds of their customers, trapped in a tedious but consuming vigilance. As a parallel example, consider the computational problem posed by a bus stop. If there is a live display saying that the next bus is arriving in 10 minutes, then you get to decide once whether to wait, rather than taking the bus's continued not coming as a stream of inferential evidence, moment by moment, and having to redecide and redecide. Moreover, you can take your attention away from squinting down the road, spinning, for those 10 minutes straight. For cities that aren't up to the implementation necessary to predict the next arrival, we saw how Bayesian inference can even make knowing when the last bus left a useful proxy. Such subtle acts of computational kindness could do as much for ridership, if not more, as subsidizing the fares. Think of it as a cognitive subsidy. If we can be kinder to others, we can also be kinder to ourselves. Not just computationally kinder, all the algorithms and ideas we have discussed will help with that, but also more forgiving. The intuitive standard for rational decision-making is carefully considering all available options and taking the best one. At first glance, computers look like the paragons of this approach, grinding their way through complex computations for as long as it takes to get perfect answers. But as we've seen, that is an outdated picture of what computers do. It's a luxury afforded by an easy problem. In the hard cases, the best algorithms are all about doing what makes the most sense in the least amount of time, which by no means involves giving careful consideration to every factor and pursuing every computation to the end. Life is just too complicated for that. In almost every domain we've considered, we have seen how the more real-world factors we include, whether it's having incomplete information when interviewing job applicants, dealing with a changing world when trying to resolve the explore-exploit dilemma, or having certain tasks depend on others when we're trying to get things done, the more likely we are to end up in a situation where finding the perfect solution takes unreasonably long. And indeed, people are almost always confronting what computer science regards as the hard cases. Up against such hard cases, effective algorithms make assumptions, show a bias towards simpler solutions, trade off the costs of error against the costs of delay, and take chances. These aren't the concessions we make when we can't be rational. They're what being rational means.
We hope you've enjoyed our presentation of Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions by Brian Christian and Tom Griffiths. Performed by Brian Christian. Directed by Paul Costanzo. Performance copyright 2016 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number. 1-800-222-3225 or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.